Welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. I'm Ted Randall, and our guest today is Jack Roland, K-E-0-V-H. And Jack is responsible for the Society of Broadcast Engineers chapter of the air that's held on IRLP and on Echolink. Along with that, Jack has a myriad of interests in ham radio. He's our guest today, right here on QSO. With me is Jack Roland, and the call sign is KE0VH. And I want to say hello to Jack, and tell us a little bit about where you're at.
Well, hey, Dad, it's so nice to get to be with you here on the radio. I haven't been on the radio as a disc jockey in a couple of 3 years now, so getting to be interviewed is quite a treat. That's pretty cool. I am located just outside of Denver, Colorado, in the city of Wheat Ridge. Here in the metro area, I am the chief engineer of the Colorado K-Love radio station, so I travel all over the state. I carry ham radio with me in my work truck, and I'm on 40 meters and 20 and whatever other band somebody else might want me on just about any time. Married for 31 years. We are the parents of eight, and we have a real good time. Three of them actually are hams. They aren't very much into it, but, you know, Dad keeps trying. So anyway, you know, we have a good time, and I've always enjoyed ham radio. Started when I was about 15 or 16, actually coincidental with the starting of my career in radio as a disc jockey at the time, and really got into broadcast engineering in the mid-90s when I was working for the Crawford Broadcasting Company. And, you know, Ted, I like to say all of my best friends in the world are either broadcast engineers or ham radio operators. So that's pretty much the case.
Well, my first commercial broadcast radio job was at WMUZ in Detroit.
And oh, well, that's a Crawford station.
Absolutely, it's a Crawford station, yeah. And, you know, I remember Don Crawford visiting the station from time to time. Now, in the beginning, when I started there, the folks that were running the station, there was a general manager's name was Chuck Cawson. And, boy, he was, I guess I want to say, grassroots radio guy. He could get on the radio and literally sell refrigerators to Eskimos.
And, yeah, you know, I got to tell you, Ted, Don Crawford Sr., the owner and manager of the company, is a wonderful, godly Christian man, as well as just a prolific broadcaster. Got to meet with him and his son, Don Jr., whom I worked for on the air and as an engineer here in Denver. And to this day, they remain very good friends. And as you may know, Don Sr.'s father, Percy Crawford, began the Crawford Broadcasting Company and was one of the big players early on in broadcast Christian radio. So there's a lot of interesting history there.
Did you ever visit WMUZ in Detroit at all? Have you ever been there?
No, sir. I have never been to Detroit, so I haven't had that pleasure.
Well, and on top of that, I think at that point in time, they also had a station in Nashville, and that was WWGM, which was an AM. And I can't remember the power level. Seems like it was 10,000 watts days and some interesting number at night. And right. I remember that Chuck Cawson Sr. came down here and where we're at and operated that station for a while, or at least got it up and running. So, but that was a different experience. And I was able to visit MUZ back, I don't know, it's been maybe a couple of years ago, 3 years ago. And it was amazing. I couldn't even recognize the place. There was nothing there that was there before, and everything was there was totally unrecognizable.
It was just, well, you know, That's one thing I've got to say. That's, again, a credit to Don Crawford Sr.'s broadcasting capabilities, and not only the business they built, but how it's grown. And my good friend Chris Alexander, also a ham, W5WCA, is the director of engineering for the company and one of my engineering mentors. I must say he's the biggest. And he stays on top of not only the latest technology, but is an innovator in so many ways in his own right. And I'm fortunate to have him here in Denver. I talk to him on the local 449-450 repeater just about every day, every week here. So we not only stay in touch, but he's a very dear and trusted friend.
You're listening to the QSL Radio Show, and we'll be right back with our guest, Jack Rowland, KE0VH, right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however, rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something. It's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's theunseenbean.com. That's theunseenbean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website. Simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioShow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our guest, Jack Rowland, KE0VH. Well, let me ask you a question now. Let's get, you know, there's a bunch of territory I want to cover talking to you. But let me ask you this. Today, right now, as you sit, what is your major interest in ham radio? What is it that you are, I guess I want to say, the most fascinated with and the most active with?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, Ted, it's really actually wide and varied. There's not a simple answer to that question. I love ham radio. I do it every day of my life. As my good friend here in Denver, Greg, WB7AHO, is fond of saying, it is the hobby that not only springboarded our careers, but is literally an everyday part of life. I love operating HF. I love operating in the mobile, in the truck, talking to friends either here on the repeater. I use it or around the world on HF mobile in the truck. I also use it an awful lot for safety, just from a simple standpoint that being a broadcast engineer as I am for K-Love Radio, I travel all over the state. I'm on remote and sometimes I'll even call them deserted mountaintops at some of these transmitter sites. And I know without a doubt that with that HF rig in the truck, if I have a serious situation or I need help or there's a problem, I can literally get on 20 meters. And even if I have to speak to somebody in Chicago, they can get on the phone and call somebody to come and help me. I also run APRS in my truck, so my wife knows where I am all the time, which is a really good thing. And my bosses all have that. Our Network Operations Center back in Rockland, California, has that information, and they can see where Engineer Jack has traveled to, or, his truck's been there for quite a while. You know, is everything all right? So, you know, it's wide and varied. I love
just as long as you're not parked at the bypass bar and grill, you're fine.
Yeah, exactly. I get some jokes about that, you know, from time to time, because guys know I run APRS all the time. But wide and varied, I do a little bit of everything with amateur radio. As you saw in my shack, I've got two HF rigs and a UHF VHF dual bander in here. One of my cardinal rules for people that I've trained under me in engineering is always bring your radio. I've been very fortunate to have a couple of assistants here in Colorado that my number one requirement for them was get your ham license. And all of my contract engineers are pretty much amateurs as well, Ted. So am I fascinated with one single thing? No, I'm fascinated with the whole nine yards.
Well, you know,
there couldn't be a better
thing. The scope of ham radio can make you ADD.
It certainly can. There's so much to do. And if you want to try it all, everything from digital modes to voice to getting back on good sounding AM, you've seen a picture of my shack. What you couldn't see down to the lower right, I have audio processors and a nice Heil classic microphone, which I think is one of the best sounding mics that Bob ever made. And of course, you saw my D104 over in the corner. So, you know, I do a little engineering here in the shack as well.
Well, here in our studio, and then when we do broadcasting, we go to the Dayton Hamvention. We're live there on WTWW for, oh gosh, the duration of the whole Hamfest. I don't even get to see the flea market, you know, but like I need to, you know. But anyhow, right. We use the Heil PR40s. And yep. Are you familiar with those at all?
I owned one and had one here in the shack, but I ran into a gentleman who really wanted to trade me a piece of gear for it, so I kind of went that direction with that particular microphone. But the Heil Classic Pro, which, by the way, I also had in use at some radio stations here in Denver when I was the chief engineer of those stations, and the guys liked them so well that we bought a whole mess of them for four radio stations there. So I'll never get rid of my Classic Pro. As a matter of fact, I told my wife, you just bury that one with me. That'll be fine.
Now, the Classic Pro looks like, what does that look like? Now, describe that over the radio.
It's a replica of an old RCA ribbon microphone. And, of course, when Bob, who, by the way, for those who might not know, Bob Heil is a ham, K9EID. When he made this, he wanted to have, of course, today's broadcast quality sound, which this microphone sounds so good, especially when you put it through a nice little broadcast mic processor. But it's a replica of an old RCA. I think it's a Model 22 ribbon microphone, and it's just a treasure, Ted.
Well, we're using all the PR40s, and then I follow that up with the Wheatstone M1 a mic processor, And that combination really sounds sweet. In the headphones, it sounds really good. But let me say this. My first introduction to the PR40 is really a funny story, and I need to tell you this because you're a broadcast engineer. I think the first time I saw one, let me think, where were we? We were at, okay, I know where it was. It was in Las Vegas, and he was doing us one of his famous Heil audio seminars, you know. Okay, if you've never been to one, go to one because it's interesting just to watch, you know. So I noticed he had an RE20 there, and I thought, well, I wonder what he's doing with that, because it was a ham function, you know, and I couldn't imagine too many hams running RE20s, but you know, what the heck. So I'm watching this, and he picks up the RE20, and it sounds terrible, you know. Yeah. Compared to the 40. Yeah. Or the 30. I thought, you know, in the back of my mind, something's wrong with that mic. You know, he's got a bad RE20. There's no way it could sound like that. Well, anyways, time went on, and he showed up here in Nashville and was doing a seminar, and my son Matt came out, and he was in the room there with the mic set, and he picked up the RE20 and talked into it, and then he picked up the PR40 and talked into it, and Bob was standing in the back of the room, and my son Matt said, "What did he do to this RE20? Did he drop it?" and Bob had this look on his face like he could just kill, you know. And I said, "Oh no, I don't think so." Well, anyways, I had ordered some new RE20s. I think I ordered four of them for our own broadcast stuff. And so Bob sent me a PR40,
mm-hmm.
and it came, and I plugged it in, and I started talking into the mic. And I'm telling you, you kind of have to learn how to talk into a 40. It's not.
You do.
You know,
you
it's
do.
Not it's not the mic that you just, you know, you don't talk direct. It's different. So anyways, but the highs are so crisp. The bottom is so faithful. It just has a really, really rich sound. Well, anyhow, I had the RE20 on, and I unplugged it, and I plugged the PR40 in, and I was like, whoa, what is this? You know?
Yep.
And I'm listening to it and talking it, and it's, you know, so I started talking up some records with it and all that kind of stuff, and I was like, boy, does this thing sound sweet. So I took it up, I took the connector, the XLR off of it, plopped it back into the RE20, and I talked into the 20, and I thought, oh my God, they're all like this.
Yep, yep.
This was terrible. You know, and I immediately listed every RE20 I had on eBay. I got rid of them, you know, because I got nothing but 40s. I've yet to fool with a microphone in the studio, and I don't do a whole lot of messing around with mics, but boy, these things here, they just do you right. I mean, they're very consistent, and you know, if you're doing voiceover work or you're live on the air, they're just a very good, faithful, bright, punchy, great sounding microphone. So I don't know what he's got in this thing, you know, who knows, probably dead mice or something, I don't know, but but it's a perfect microphone. But that was really, if I thought it was kind of a funny story, because we were thinking, man, he must have dropped that RE20 or something. It sounded so bad. But when I had it in the studio, it was like, uh-oh, this really sounds good. Now, Dave Ramsey has on his set the Heil Classic that you're talking about. He's got it sitting there on the desk. I don't think they're using it because he uses these headsets, you know. But they kind of zoom in on that microphone when they're going and coming from breaks and whatnot. Well, let me ask... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, not to be a commercial, you know, for Heil microphones, Ted, but a funny story there too, real quick. I almost got in trouble at a set of radio stations I worked at because I set up a PR40. I set up, I believe it was a PR30 as well. I had a Rode microphone. I had an RE27. I had an RE27D. I did this whole line of microphones, and almost to a person, with the exception of two, everybody liked the Heil mics the best. And I almost got in trouble for that, because then everybody wanted to purchase all these new microphones. It was just a crazy day, you know.
Well, I went into the studio when we had 102.5 The Party here, and there was a guy on the air, and I said, "Let me just do one thing." I said, "Let me take this mic off and put this one on. Use this a little while and see what you think." So I put the mic in, and he's got the headphones on, and he's doing, you know, he's DJing records. And I'd forgot about it. You know, I was getting ready to leave to go home, and I went back in there, and I thought I was going to have to tie him up or something to get that microphone back. He did not want to give up that mic.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. You know, I don't doubt it.
Well, I don't care if it's a commercial or not, because I just think that I think Bob's products are just head and shoulders over everything. He's put a lot of work into them, and it costs a lot of money to run a company where you got to wear all those different crazy looking sneakers, you know, where you got to put on these different colored sneakers all the time. So right, I hope he does really well and sells lots of microphones. So
Bob's an incredible guy, and he has done so much for the amateur radio community as well. And he deserves an awful lot of credit and accolades for that. And, you know, every year at the National Association of Broadcasters convention out in Las Vegas, which I was privileged to attend this last week, as of this chat, Bob, of course, hosts the ham radio reception. And every year, it's basically standing room only there at the National Association of Broadcasters Convention. And I had to come back to Denver before I could go to that this year, so I missed out on it. But what an event, and what a man who's done an awful lot for amateur radio.
Well, I want to ask you, with your current interest in all these different parts of ham radio, where did you ever first hear of amateur radio?
Well, I'll tell you, that's an easy one to answer. Back when I was 13 or 14, and actually I think when I was 12, I started listening, as you and I were discussing off air here, to a bunch of shortwave stations, including HCJB in Quito, Ecuador. And the thing about HCJB, it was a Christian broadcaster from the Andes, the mountains in the Andes there, and neat thing about that little sidebar story here is one day I had a friend who was a missionary for HCJB, and he had me do some liners and some voiceovers for him. And that was the most incredible thing in the world, was hearing my voice come back over this legendary radio station that I had listened to forever, over the short waves when I was 20, you know, coming from Ecuador, South America. It's another part of the magic of ham radio. But what really got me started was the shortwave listening, playing with a couple of CB walkie-talkies, and then getting into CB radio, as so many of us did when I was 13 or 14. And I had a good friend of mine who was a CBer, and he ran a linear amplifier and ran power and all those things that CBers weren't supposed to do. But then he found out about amateur radio, and he said, you know, Jack, you really got to get into this. So when I was 15, I started saving all the money I could make during the summer working a job, and took my novice test at the time, when you had to actually have 5 words a minute of, you know, Morse code, and got my license in and got on the air, and about 2 years later became a general class and actually started in broadcast radio at my hometown Chattanooga, Tennessee radio station WFLI. And became a disc jockey there, and just continued on with ham radio. And believe it or not, I still know all those fly jocks, as we were called in the day, to this day, and some of them are still very good friends, and we got together for a reunion last year, and several of them are hams, and we talk on the radio. So rich history, Ted, rich history.
I was going to say that when you were talking about Citizens Band Radio, and I mean, I've had folks on the air that act as if, you know, I got started in Citizens Band Radio, I kind of take issue with that, because I started in Citizens Band Radio, you know.
Yeah,
and I don't have an eye in the middle of my forehead, and if you check the back of my head, I don't have any horns popping out back there anywhere. But I don't know what era you were into it, but in the era that I was into it, the most popular radios at the time, I started with a Knight 2590, 8-channel transmitter.
Absolutely.
And a 23-channel variable receive. And then I advanced to a Citiphone SS, which was made by the Multi Elmac Company over in, I guess, Royal Oak, Michigan. Went over to the factory and actually picked one up. They only put out about 2.5 watts. They weren't like the other rigs that put out 3 or 3.5. Like the Courier 23, the Comstat 25, the upper crust was like the Tram Titan and the Browning Eagle. But then there was the let's see, I said the Comstat 25. What else was there? There was Executive, made a whole line of those radios, and then I'm trying to think. And the Comstat, of course, was Lafayette, the Lafayette radio electronics people. And I bought a couple of radios from the Olson Company, which was kind of strange. But Citizens Band back then was different. And then I got employed by some local guys that were selling these amps that were made by a company. Let me think. They were in Scotts Bluff. I think it was Scotts Bluff. I think I got this right. DNA was the company, and they put out a small amp that was a what they called a Hornet. I think it put out about 50 watts. Then they had the Raider, which had four sweep tubes in it. We put out about 125 watts. Then they had the Maverick. I think the Maverick had eight, and it put out 250. And then there was the Phantom, which had 12 sweep tubes in it.
Oh my gosh.
I put out about 500 watts dead carrier with, you know, of course, with audio. And the Phantom was really good for wiping televisions out in your neighborhood. Okay. It would just do a great job of that. But Citizens Band was different then than it is now. And it was a little community of people that was on the air talking. And when I was younger, they had these things called coffee breaks.
And, absolutely.
And these guys would all get together, and you'd go in there, and the smoke would be so thick you couldn't breathe. But they'd have like a band in there, and people would be dancing, and they'd be drinking coffee, and I guess beer, too. I don't know what all they were drinking, but because I was too young at the time to really realize too much of that. But they were always raising money for someone, some unfortunate CB or something had happened, and that was the purpose of the coffee breaks. And but it was a different kind of thing, you know. And honestly, I really miss that in ham radio. I don't know. I just sometimes I wish that the 2 meter band could turn into that sort of a community, you know, where it would be people on the air talking and getting together and going having coffee and just, you know, I mean, you know, kind of a community kind of thing, you know. And I kind of miss that. It's a little too cold on 2 meters, yes, for me at times. I don't know. But I like your idea of being mobile, because and honestly, when you're traveling across the country, sometimes you can't even raise somebody on 2 meters.
Yeah, that's for sure.
They're not there. But you can find somebody on 20 or 17, but on 20 especially. You could raise some, you know. And even if they are halfway across the country, they can still pick up the phone and make a phone call for you. If you don't have cell service, or you're in an area where there's something really crazy going on. So I totally applaud that. I think that's really cool. But Citizens Band Radio, I just wanted to let you know that, you know, you're not the only one that started. What kind of rigs did you run on Citizens Band, or do you recall?
Oh, yeah, I remember very well. And just real quickly, back to the shortwave listening that took me there, too. I actually still have the original little General Electric shortwave receiver that I had when I was 13 years old. And I had even dropped it in the lake one time when I was 16 or 17. And I took it out and dried it out very carefully. And the thing is sitting on the shelf behind me here, Ted, and it still works to this day.
I was going to interrupt you and tell you something. Your chair, something is squeaking, which it doesn't bother me, but you may get some emails with people saying, we can hear your chair squeaking. The audio is really good, but I just thought I'd tell you that. Now continue your story.
Oh, no, that's quite all right. And I heard it too. So I'll sit a little stiller here, as it were. My first CB radio was a realistic TRC-24C, 23-channel rig, had that nice little wood grain front on it, and I just thought the world of that radio, and I actually see them every now and then on eBay here, and I think, man, it'd be fun to have that, even if for no other reason, just to sit in the shack and look kind of cool. I have a very, very warm, heartfelt affinity for CB radio, because in the Chattanooga, Tennessee area where I grew up and started with all that, there were some really nice folks that were just very welcoming, you know, fun to talk to, welcomed a young kid in, and some of them, you know, were old men and old women. And, you know, of course, I was like so many others of that mid to late 70s era. I was a big Smokey and the Bandit fan. So, you know, there was no cooler thing than, you know, watching the Bandit and the Snowman, you know, cruising down the road, evading the Smokies back in those days. Those were my favorite movies as a teenage kid. So I have a great love for it, and it eventually led me to amateur radio and broadcasting and everything else that's been a part of my life.
Well, you know, and I think, you know, I'll tell you something. I said this the other day on the air, and I'm probably going to get shot for this, okay? But I think, in all seriousness, they should allow amateur radio operators to operate on 11 meters using their call sign. And the reason why I say that is because I think it's an excellent pool for prospective hams.
Now, I would agree. I would agree with that. And, you know, the amateurs originally had the 11 meter band, which is the CB band there. And I would see no problem with that personally, you know, with there being some crossover activity at all.
Yeah, I think it would be really a good thing. But however, when I travel on a trip, I always take a Citizens Band radio with me. And I always have one of the mobile because, like I said, and I'm scolding other guys because I leave 2 meters on as much as I possibly can. And, you know, when I'm working, if somebody, if I hear an amateur on 2 meters, I will always answer them, even if I can only talk for a minute or so. I always try to go back to them. I hate this business of people calling on two and no one home.
Yeah, I understand.
I think it's a little discouraging from the standpoint that, as they say, if you don't use it, you lose it. And I think that's true with, of course, all of the bands. But nonetheless, on 2 meters, it would be, I just wish. I remember the early days in ham radio when everybody was running those Motorola tube-type rigs converted over to 2 meters. And the audio was incredible. And they did have, at that time, more of a community kind of thing going. So I don't know what's happened in the meantime. I don't know. I guess we've all gotten rude and something. I don't know.
But, well, you know, Ted, you know, there's an awful lot of that same community. And I'm going to turn up a little audio here for you. I believe you should be able to hear it. There's an awful lot of that type of community that goes on these days in nets, networks of people that get on the air and discuss different things or say howdy or hello or, you know, whatever the case may be and just visit and so on and so forth every evening at 7:30. On 3.989 megahertz on the 75 meter band, I check into the Colorado Columbine net. It used to be more or less a wide area traffic net, which is official title for it right now, the official title, you know, where people would handle messages and send messages to different cities and everything and so on and so forth. And, of course, with the internet and email, that's kind of become a thing of the past. Many people do not understand that the American Radio Relay League, our beloved ARRL organization for ham radio, started as a group of hams who would relay messages across the country. And it grew and grew and grew. And every night back in the day when transmission wasn't as easy necessarily as it is today, they had to relay messages across the country. Hence the American Radio Relay League. And there are so many communities of these nets, as we call them today, that gather on the air, get on the air, say hello, you know, tell what the weather's doing wherever they are, or gee, I just built a new antenna today, how does it sound, whatever the case may be.
And I look forward to it. You take care and have a good one. Glad you got some watering done and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, I got a little natural sprinkler thing going here a little while ago and earlier this afternoon, so wasn't much, but it's a little.
That, Ted, I recognize that voice. I've been on this net so many times. That is Sid down in Colorado Springs. His call is K4ARM, and he's running the Columbine net and obviously having a chat with somebody on the net. So there's so much of that that goes on. There's a lot of communities. There's a good group of guys on my local repeater here that I talk to nearly every day. Most of them are broadcast engineers, but not all of them. And, you know, we'll get on the air or we'll be driving around during the commute here in Denver, or this is a wide area repeater as well, so I can talk to guys back in Denver from way up in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And, you know, the communities are there, so don't give up. Hope is not completely lost. The communities are definitely there within amateur radio. You just got to kind of look for them a little bit.
Well, you know, I was going to say, a lot of guys are, especially, say, on 75, which is one of my favorite bands, they get, I guess I want to say.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got things falling on me here. you might want to edit that part out.
Okay. The thing is that a lot of guys get on 75, and there are some nets on there that if you try to check in, or I want to say more, not as much nets, as I would say groups of people, if you try to check in, they aren't necessarily the most friendly people. They're kind of closed off, you know, and very, you know, they've been talking there for years, you know, so all of a sudden here comes this outsider. And once somebody gets snubbed like that, you know, they tend to think, well, this band is just like this. So what I've suggested, and I keep saying this, as much frequency space as there is, especially on 75 meters, people ought to get back in the habit of calling CQ and go down and find a frequency where there's nobody there and just sit there and call CQ. And within a matter of just a short period of time, you'll probably have not just an answer, but once two guys get to talking, then somebody else jumps in, and then you next, you know, get somebody else in there. And before you over, you got four or five people, you know, that are in there in a round table talking just after, you know, just because one guy went to a blank frequency and called CQ. And I think it's become a lost art. We just don't do it as much anymore. You know, people are looking to break in on an existing round table, and that's fine. But I guess I would say if you're going to go in on a round table, maybe you ought to listen for three or four nights ahead of time and kind of get the feel of what's going on here and who the people are and what they're talking about and that sort of thing. Because sometimes when we just jump in on somebody else's group, I guess I want to say, we really don't have any feel for it. We don't know what they're all about. And, you know,
That's a good point. That's a good point. Listening is actually and should be the number one operating skill in amateur radio. Listen a little bit, especially as you say, you might get to try to know some people and what they're like before you necessarily jump in on that kind of conversation. But on the other hand, too, Ted, don't be afraid to jump in and say hello. And if that group, you know, and there are some who are like that, but you know, it's kind of that way in any walk of life. You know, you kind of have to not only be aware of your surroundings to some degree, but, you know, kind of get to know the people that that are there. See what they're like. Listen in. See if they're welcome. But calling CQ is always a wonderful thing to do. And yes, sometimes the bands are quiet or it may be late at night and maybe that part of the band, you know, just doesn't have a lot going on or the band may be dead. And even if the band is dead, and I do this all the time on 6 meters, get on and call CQ anyway and just see what happens because you never know. Maybe the band is alive, but there's just not a lot of activity at that point. And you know, there are, as in any hobby or as in any endeavor, there are a few bad apples. You do have to watch out for some of those, but it's that way anywhere in life. Don't let that disappoint you or keep you from how rewarding, you know, your amateur radio hobby can be.
Well, you know, I think a lot of times it's really kind of funny. Don't you think it's strange during a contest how all these bands come to life that have been dead? You know, I mean, I mean, and there's nothing wrong with, and I've had this happen before, 11, 12 o'clock at night. I just flip on the 15 meter band and get in there and call CQ. And by goodness, here comes two or three people back to me. And I mean,
a lot of times they're in Russia even, so yeah, you never know where somebody might be listening.
But they've tuned in and they don't hear anything. You know, people don't hear anything, so then they just go away. They just go in there and tune. But I think a lot of times band openings are there that we don't know anything about because there's no contest or there's no reason for anybody to be transmitting. They don't go up there and just say, okay, here I am. Let's see what happens, you know. And I think we need to be a little bit more brave and a little more bold and get on and call CQ when you don't hear anything.
Absolutely.
Because I think it's a catch 22. You don't hear nothing. They don't hear anything. So nobody says anything.
And, absolutely. Get on and try. You know, key that microphone. You betcha.
But I mean, how many times have you heard like 15 meters just be dead and then all of a sudden it's field day? And then it's hopping like an 8-cylinder motor. You know, it's like Well, the day before, it was still hopping like an 8-cylinder motor. There was just nobody there, you know. And so anyways, that's just a passing thought. The other thing too, and that is, I mean, and I can tell you know what I'm talking about because you've done disc jockey work. You've been on ham radio for a pretty good while. One of the things that I see about calling CQ on the air, there's a lot of fellas that are afraid to get on and do that. I don't know why. There's a fear of it. There's kind of a microphone fear in ham radio for some guys. I think the key to this thing is kind of planning ahead of time the format that you're going to follow when you get on. So, for example, when you call CQ and the guy gets on the air, start asking him questions like ask about his family, ask about his occupation, ask what kind of car he drives. I mean, you know what I mean? In other words, you know, put the attention on the other person and make that time used well to find out all you can about this guy you're talking to. I think that's what makes it so interesting, you know, especially when you get to talking about occupations, you know, and family members. And I think,
you know,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to add to that, Ted. You're absolutely right. And it's like anything when you're with somebody new or whatever. As men, we know this with our wives. Wives want conversation and they want you to be interested in them. Well, you know, it's that way with just about any form of conversation that you might have the opportunity to try. Yeah, don't be afraid to jump in there and ask some of those questions. Just like you said, what do you do for a living? Wow, that's interesting. How far do you have to travel every day? Or, you know, is it a long commute? Or, you know, tell me some more about the aspects of your job. And on top of that, too, I just looked this up as you were saying this, but put in how to start a ham radio contact in your Google. And there's all kinds of stuff. Amateur radio, where to start? How to set up your first station? Making your first contact? How to talk to someone using amateur radio? There's all kinds of great information. You know, you can Google anything these days, and you know that type of information is there as well. If you're mic shy or you're just kind of shy or a little anxious to start with about you know, how do I talk to somebody I don't even know in Australia? Well, the same way you talk to anybody else. You ask them a few questions and say hello, and my name is, and I do this. What do you do? So you make some great points there. And those who may be listening who you know, or just starting out in amateur radio, don't be afraid, again, to key that microphone and say, hello, my name is, what's yours? That sort of thing.
Let me ask you this question. Now, let's digress a bit here. And what was your very, very first ham rig?
My very first ham rig was a Tentec Argonaut 509 5-watt rig, and I ran it with a 12-volt Radio Shack power supply. As a matter of fact, the same power supply that had powered my CB radio. You know, that, though I was a novice and that was Morse code, so at that time, I didn't have to speak into a microphone. However, as you may can tell here, and us both being radio guys, you know, I've never been too afraid of a microphone to start with. So, you know, I've never had a trouble finding something to say. But the first time I made that voice contact, I, of course, didn't want to sound dumb or anything. And I don't remember it specifically, but I do remember, wow, I'm keying a microphone and my voice is going all over creation. That was quite a thrill.
Well, you listen to HCJB. I'm curious, who was your friend that worked there? Can you mention their name, or is it?
Well, yeah, I'd be happy to. He is still, and his wife Karen are still missionaries with HCJB. His name is Kurt Cole, Kurt has been down there since, good golly, I don't know, 20, 25 years now. And they're based, of course, the base for that ministry is in Colorado Springs, although I don't think they're calling themselves HCJB World Radio anymore. I think they've got another title in there because, you know, unfortunately, there's just not as much shortwave broadcasting as, you know, back when we were a little younger. But Kurt was my friend there, and he still is working in that ministry.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing because a friend of mine that worked at WMUZ in Detroit, his name was Tom Adams, and I can't remember Tom's call, but he went to work for HCJB and was there for a pretty good while. And then another fellow that I know who and his wife worked at HCJB for, goodness, 20 years. He's a radio engineer. He lives in Chattanooga and is an expert, absolute expert on most large transmitters. And and his name is John Stanley, John and Ruth Stanley. And John will come in and work on our stuff periodically. They both come in as a couple and work on transmitters for us. And but he's an expert at it, just a total expert. And he also worked for Transworld Radio.
Nice.
On, I think, Guam. And I don't know. I think he worked in Bonaire as well. I don't know. But when I was a kid, I tuned in. I could hear HCJB. And then I could also hear, you know, from the Island of the Flamingos, you know, and they'd play the sound of those birds, and they would say, this is Trans World Radio, Bonaire, Netherlands Antilles, you know. But, of course, HCJB's moniker was the voice of the Andes, you know.
Right,
and, right. I listened to both of those stations, and they had Christian programming. I mean, they had stuff, normal stuff, like, you know, Back to the Bible with Theodore Epp and all these other standard programs, but they also did some mailbag programs, excuse me, and those are really fun to listen to. But, you know, here's the thing that I don't understand, and that is, we get on the air on Saturday and Sunday nights, and we have a good time basically playing country music here out of Nashville, and my goodness, you talk about, you know, emails coming in. We can get 600 emails the first hour we're on.
And, that's fabulous.
You know, and I see people saying, well, there's nobody listening to shortwave radio. Well, let me forward my email to your email address for the evening on Saturday night, okay? And then come back and tell me that again, okay?
Absolutely.
You know, it's I think, personally, I think that if anything, do you remember a fellow by the name of Willis Conover?
No, I don't know that name.
Well, he was on VOA, and he did a jazz show. And the BBC, and I don't know how they come up with these numbers, the BBC estimated that his show had approximately 30 million listeners. Wow. And this was back years ago when shortwave radios, all shortwave radios, had tubes in them, and they sat on a desktop in a pretty good-sized wooden box. Okay, so that was during that particular period of time and era, but now we have shortwave radios that fit in the palm of your hand, that are battery operated. Matter of fact, most of these things that are made by the Texon company over in Beijing, that have brand names on them like Grundig and whatnot, those things rival an old Hallicrafters receiver with a 100-foot piece of wire on it. I mean, these little radios are phenomenal. And so, yep, people, you can sit outside in the, you know, in your lawn chair and hold the thing in your hand, or set it on a table and pull the whip antenna up, and you've got the world at your fingertips. You know, so I don't know. I at first I was kind of depressed. I was hearing certain countries are going off the air and all that. I think to myself, okay, fine, let them go off the air, because that just makes it a little bit easier to tune us in.
Well, yeah, absolutely, Ted. And, you know, there still are a lot of people listening to shortwave. And I am a collector of Zenith transoceanic radios. I have several of those. My wife and I have several tube radios that we just really love. And just recently, I obtained a 1928 RCA Radiola 60 radio that had been fully restored, and this now has a place of prominence in our living room upstairs. My wife thought it was so beautiful. Hey, let's put that in the living room. And we just love it. And there's something that is so magical about listening to those old tube radios, as far as that goes. And between myself and my good friend Greg, WB7AHO, another engineer ham friend of mine here in the Denver area, what I couldn't fix, he fixed. And these radios have been restored and are beautiful. And I'll have some pictures of them up on my new KE0VH.com webpage here before too long.
You're listening to the QSL Radio Show, and we'll be right back with our guest Jack Rowland, KE0VH, right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either, there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website. Simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioShow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our guest, Jack Rowland, KE0VH.
Check those out sometime because there's just such a magic there. And there's still, to this day, every time that I turn on this D104 microphone or my ICOM microphone or the Hio Classic Pro microphone and talk to somebody in Australia, I worked China here a couple of weeks ago for the very first time during a DX contest. The magic of radio is still so rich and full and exciting to me. I wish I could translate that to my kids in today's internet world, and it's becoming more difficult. But, you know, for people who will pick up those radios and go, wow, you know, it's magic. And with today's technology, you know, the reception just gets even better.
Well, I'll tell you, you talk about the magic of radio. The magic of shortwave radio is even more, I guess I'm going to say, mysterious. You know, when you hear that music coming at you with the phase shift that comes in off of the selective fading, you know, it just is a, I don't know, there's just, you can't hardly duplicate that anywhere. But what I was going to say is Christmas time now, that we had Jamie Labadia, who is an engineer that worked for the Energionics company for a number of years until, of course, they went out of business. And but Jamie went over into, he was in South Korea. He built, what is that, the Voice of Freedom, I think it is, built the transmitters from scratch, you know, in the field. So he came and he was working on our transmitters here, and he said, can you put some audio on for me for a little bit while I'm doing it? And I said, sure. So I got the audio up and running, and I was playing Christmas music. Well, we played, I don't know, 30 minutes worth of Christmas music, and the next thing you know, I'm getting a couple of emails in, people saying, oh, this is cool, you know. And then I got a picture of a guy send me a one of his antique radios that he collected, and it's sitting right beside his Christmas tree. And something just hit me. I don't know. I just thought, you know what? I just got this feeling. So we put Christmas music on and just let it run right on up until, you know, Christmas Day. And I ran a little promo that said, send us a picture of your classic radio. And let's allow shortwave radio to take the place of the electric train under the Christmas tree.
Oh, see, wow, that's awesome.
See what kind of troublemaker I am. I'm not kidding you. We have so many photographs of beautiful, gorgeous, incredible old radios that came in. I mean, it's up in the thousands that we've got. Thousands of people sent us pictures of these old radios. And I've got to get them. Every one I have got to put up on the website. I have just got to do this.
I'll have to send you a whole bunch of them here, Ted, because I've got about 10 of them.
Well, you know, I had so many folks respond, and then they started sending video clips. Oh, my goodness. So now they've got the Christmas tree and the bubble lights going, and there's the old radio, and you can hear Bing Crosby's White Christmas playing, and the dial lit up, and oh, man, I'm telling you what, I don't think my feet touched the ground for the entire month of December, because every 15 minutes we were getting five or six pictures in. And there was one fella, and I lost contact with him, but he wasn't a ham. He had a floor model shortwave radio in a mall, an antique mall, down in, I think it was Alabama. And he wrote me an email and said that the mall owner came over to him and said, why don't you plug that old radio in, and if it'll work, tune in a station so that the people coming by know it works and somebody will buy it, you know. So he turned it on, and he was looking on the AM band, and he couldn't find anything. He said there was, you know, a bunch of talking and on different things, but he said there's nothing they wanted to leave on that radio. So he flipped the shortwave, and he said he started tuning, and he just, you know, made about a, you know, about an inch of movement on the tuning knob, and all of a sudden, wham, there was this Christmas music coming in really strong. And so he said he just left it on the Christmas music. And so he said that that old radio playing Christmas music during the month of December at that shopping mall was like the highlight of the entire place. And he sent me a picture of the radio. And so I asked him, I said, what do you want for it? He said, well, we're selling it for $150. I said, you know what? I don't know how I'll get it to Nashville, but I want the radio, and the story's worth $150. So anyhow, but I don't know. I lost track of the guy somehow, and we never were able to get together, but I still got the picture of the radio. But I thought that was just so cool. There's the magic of radio at work. In other words, there's this old radio that nobody, you know, was probably abandoned in a basement somewhere that nobody much cared about, and he brought it up and sat it up there and wanted to see if somebody would buy it. But then as soon as he tuned in the Christmas music, you know, on shortwave, and the people in the mall were passing by, it just turned into a source of magic. You know, it really did. It was just that feeling that you get when something's special, you know. And I thought that was just really, really cool.
You know, that's an awesome story. And Ted, I want to show you a couple of things that I think you'll like here via our video here. Here is now do the magic of radio here, which people listening to us can experience. But here is, and I wish this were TV at the moment so that everybody could see it. But here is that GE Globestar radio that got me started. Now you can see this. And of course, others can't. But
I mean, it looks. Yeah, I mean, it looks like it went through the war somewhere or something. I mean, that radio looks.
Yeah. And you know, this radio is from approximately 1970, 71, I think, when it was brand new. But she still works and still plays to this day.
Just like
as a matter of fact, so if you can hear it.
Happens, you don't judge. just endure, you prevail.
So they're evidently in a commercial there. I don't know if you could hear that very well or not over the microphone here. But there's that radio. But then let me show you this one. Now, this one I'll have to reach over and grab. But look at this one now.
Now, he's just picked up a Zenith Transoceanic radio that have you restored this one? Is this one that you've done?
This one is fully restored. It sure is. It's a little dusty because it's been sitting on the shelf, but it totally plays and just sounds absolutely marvelous. You can see the dial.
Now, let me ask you a question on those transoceanics.
Sure.
Do they have multiple bands of shortwave?
They do.
Okay, and do they cover? I was just curious what the frequency coverage was on those things.
Well, they essentially cover from the broadcast band, our standard AM broadcast band. This one covers to the 31-meter band, which is about tops out at about 16 megahertz. So that one covers all of this in, six, seven bands here on this particular radio.
The reason why I ask is there's some radios today that skip over portions of the shortwave bands, and then a lot of stations have operated outside of the standard shortwave bands. And I was just wondering how the transoceanic. I've never actually walked up to one and actually played with it. I've seen plenty of them around. I always thought they were a very cool, extremely cool looking radio. And
I'm going to show you the backside of it. You can see all the tubes.
Tubes, and I see a transformer. I see a cap that's looks like it's either in a socket or it's in attached to the chassis permanently and wired from the underside, obviously.
This is a heavy radio too, I'll tell you. It's got some heft to it.
Let me ask you this question. Now, you started in broadcast radio. Why don't you tell folks this? How does amateur radio enable you or enable a young person to, I guess I want to say, get into broadcast radio as a profession?
Well, let me just tell you, that's a great question, and it leads me to a couple of things that I was hoping we might get to discuss here. One thing that amateur radio did for me, obviously, has got me interested not only in the fun of talking and making friends, but the actual electronics in of the actual technical side of it, learning what Ohm's law means and how does DC power differ from AC power and how does a battery work and how does a battery make a radio work, and all of that kind of stuff just really fascinated me from the very beginning. I even wrote papers on electronic subjects in high school, and I had a teacher who gave me good grades, but she said, I never can understand what it is you're writing about, but it's very well written. So, that's the thing that so many people who have a technical interest, who think that they might enjoy learning some of this, amateur radio is the perfect entry point to do so. And again, that's kind of what got me started. I started working as a part-time disc jockey, as I said, at WFLI in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and the transmitter there, Ted, you'd love it, and it's still there, and it still operates, but it was a Western Electric, big, almost homebrew transmitter with all kinds of tubes, open cabinetry that in the day and still could be very dangerous if you don't know what you're doing and you don't want to go over there and grab that, you know, piece of metal sticking out of it because there might be 10,000 volts or more on it. But it just fascinated me to no end. And today, with the technical careers that we have available, everything from to cell phone technology, to how the internet works and how broadband works and how broadcast radio still works to this day. There are so many open areas for people to become excited about learning a technical skill and getting involved with something a little more, shall we say, than appliance operating.
Well, you know, I guess the thing of it is I've got two sons that are radio engineers, okay? And they all came up through ham radio. And I keep saying the engineers in the broadcast industry that are hams, every time I have contact with them or a project to work on, they always seem to have a far more practical ability to visualize. It just seems like they're more connected to what we're working with and what we're doing. And
Let me interject this, Ted, because this is very important. We talk about this in the engineering broadcast industry, as I'm sure that you do as well. You're very well aware of the fact that, unfortunately, us engineers, we're getting older, and there are not so many of us in the fold anymore. And when we get the opportunity to bring in someone that's young and is excited about learning not only broadcast engineering, but all the technical material in general, then it's a wonderful thing. There are many, many jobs open in this field as well in so many places, not only for big companies, but for a contract engineer. And a lot of I know a lot of guys that are making a very good living doing what they love every day as contract engineers. And, you know, you probably have the same experience I do. I don't work a day in my life. My job is fun. It's different every day. I get to play radio every day, no matter where I am. You know, it just couldn't be any better. And there are openings in this field for more people to come in and learn and grow and make a profession and a life for themselves.
Well, I'll tell you, we have a group here. You see, we're all my wife, Holly, is the head of IT. I guess you want to call it that for a group of stations here in town. I'm the chief engineer. And over us is a fellow who is the director of corporate engineering, takes care of all of the company. And but we're more on the local scene, taking care of this group of stations in Nashville, and then my two sons are one works for Tribeca Nazarene University. They've got radio stations there, a couple, and some translators, and then he takes care of all their audio video stuff for the sports department, and when they televise all their sports stuff over the internet. And of course, Matt is chief engineer for the Dave Ramsey Show, which entails all kinds of things. But what's interesting is we all work as a group. If there's a crisis and it's 2:00 in the morning and the phone rings, you know, and so I'll pick up the phone and I'll call them and I'll say, well, it looks like something's off the air or they may have a problem. Well, we're all up and running at 2:00 in the morning, and then all of a sudden the adrenaline starts to flow. Have you experienced that? Is that how it is?
Oh no, never, never. As you were saying that, my mind raced through. I have, as I said earlier, I have so many good, best engineering friends here in Denver and even down to Colorado Springs from here. And, you know, we all help each other out. The other day, yesterday, I was up in Fort Collins working on proofing, what we call proofing a radio station for FCC rules and all this kind of stuff. And I had my station, which is down southwest of Rye, Colorado, south of Pueblo, Colorado, almost down to the New Mexico line. And I called my first contractor. He wasn't available. I called my second contractor. He was up in Sterling, way up in the northeast part of the state. And finally, I called the guy that I said, I'll call you the third time. You're kind of third on the list here, but if I have an emergency, would you mind, you know, going and taking care of this for me? And the station had gone off the air, and I called my buddy Ray, who is also a ham, Alpha Alpha Zero Lima, AA0L, and I said, Ray, my station's off the air down at Rye. You got time this afternoon? And sure enough, he's the chief engineer for the Cumulus Cluster down in Colorado Springs. And Ray went down and put that station back on the air for me. So, we have all kinds of great camaraderie. And I think it's that way pretty much with the whole broadcast engineering and the amateur radio community as well, Ted.
Well, I was going to say, because what happens with us is we wake up and, you know, and we all converge on a transmitter site. But it's like, even though it's 2:00 in the morning and you've got an off-air condition or whatever, It's like everybody is primed. It's like, okay, here we are. You know, we're on our and with us, we're kind of a group. We've worked together to the point where you don't even have to talk to each other. We all just go in different directions, checking different things. You know, somebody's got the lid off the vault, and we're checking to see if voltage is getting into the main power supply area. You know, and we've got the tube cavity open, and we're looking inside there to see if there's an exploded doorknob capacitor or something. You know, but it's like we're all going in different directions, but all working exactly at the same time, and at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'll tell you, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of people would think, oh man, I don't want to get woke up at 2 o'clock. But you know, doctors go through the same thing. It's 2 a.m., and all of a sudden the surgeon's phone rings, and he's got to rush over to the hospital and fix something on someone's body. But you know, it's the same thing. That's they live for that. It's exciting. It's you know, it's motivating, you know, because when you're you're done and you got it fixed, then everybody heads over to Waffle House or whatever, you know. And but I guess I want to say I don't think there's a whole lot of professions out there that give you that kind of challenge and then satisfaction afterwards. I mean, and I may be wrong, but I think we are in the same league as open heart surgery surgeons that do that kind of thing, or that do, you know, brain operations or whatever at 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is. I think it puts us in that class.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. And there's nothing like driving away from a transmitter site and listening to the radio signal that you have just fixed, and it's back on the air, and it's there. And especially in the case of K-Love, you know, ministering to people who may need to hear that certain song or that certain good news at that certain point in their lives. So I'm very tunnel visioned when it comes to one of my stations being off air. And if I can't get to it, sending a contractor out, keeping up with them, and, you know, they're just as excited about getting this thing fixed for the people who need it. You know, so many times I've heard stories, even of not just about Christian radio, but, you know, I being an all-night disc jockey at one time here in Denver, like I was, there were people who were working, you know, the overnight hotel thing, or I got calls from police folks all the time who were listening to the radio and said, man, you make it so much fun. I'm so glad you're there. You're like my best friend at night. So, you know, there's a real personal aspect to it all. There's so much about it that I love passionately. And, you know, it just could not be any better working in this field that I do, having the hobby and the friends that I do. And, you know, it's exciting. It's fun. It's new every day. If somebody is looking to get into that field of things, by all means, explore it and jump into it. Find a mentor and, you know, just go for it, because you're going to have so much fun and it's going to be so rewarding.
You're listening to the QSL Radio Show, and we'll be right back with our guest, Jack Rowland, KE0VH, right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention was the number of people that came up to the QSL Radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either they're cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it, because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's hamtestonline.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply qsoradioshow.com. That's Q QSORadioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our guest, Jack Rowland, KE0VH. Well, tell me something. You care for how many radio stations?
I look after 43 different radio transmitter sites.
Oh, man. Well, when does your phone stop ringing?
You know, the nice thing is everything's pretty well equipped, and I don't necessarily have to drive from Denver to Durango, which is about 7 hours, if something goes off the air. I have folks down in that part of the state. My job in particular is more to manage the area than it is necessarily to have hands on. But again, as I said earlier, just today I was up in Cheyenne, Wyoming, which is about, almost 2 hours from Denver, working at one of my sites up there. And then later, me and my contractor buddy Rich, also a ham again, W9BNO, we stopped off at the station in Fort Collins to try to get some software to talk, which we still had problems with today. But, you know, it involves a whole bunch of just good working and good fun and seeing beautiful country. And in my particular position, my job is more to manage, but yet I do have an awful lot of hands-on too, and I love every minute of it.
Well, now let me ask you this question: when you're traveling around, are you operating 75 meters or 40 or 20 out of the automobile or van or whatever you're driving?
Yeah, well, most of the time during the daytime, I'm on 40 meters, and I'm on the frequency of 7.185 kilohertz, or 7.185 megahertz, I should say, because that's just a frequency where most of my friends know I'm going to be monitoring when I'm driving around the state. But I do jump on 20 meters, and I've got a another one of my K-Love engineers who was my assistant here in Colorado at one time. His name is Patrick, and his call is KD0TRZ, and he actually is based out in eastern Pennsylvania. And Patrick is a ham, and he's in the process of getting his truck set up with an ICOM 706 Mark II. I have a Mark IIG in my truck, and he's going to get his 20-meter ham stick on so we can talk to each other cross-country as we're driving around during the day.
Oh, that's interesting, because I've got one of those radios here, yes. So guys like to talk about rigs, you know, I like to hear about old rigs, you know, I like to hear about the old stuff,
yeah.
You know, but I was going to say when you're operating mobile, when you're on 40 meters, 40 is a band that's just there all the time is what I like. You know, I like about 40 is it's there all the time. It's not like 20, doesn't go down at sundown. And, and of course you've got a fairly good distance on it. You can work some DX on 40 sometimes. It just blow your mind. But now tell me something. You have a net that's with the Society of Broadcast Engineers.
Yep.
And I want you to tell us a little bit about that. Now, I'll tell you what. I used to, when I was on the doing QSO, I used to have, we talked to hams, and they would be always, they were broadcast engineers. And they were kind of beside themselves, said, well, you know what? I've only got a general ticket, and they put that net up in the extra portion. And he said, I can't operate there. And I said, well, I don't know. And I mentioned that to somebody once. I don't remember when it was. I talked to somebody, maybe John Poré or somebody in the group, and I never heard any more. So I was wondering, is that still the case?
Well, you know what? They do have the HF version of what we call the SBE Hamnet. But what I did, I don't know, it's been 5 or 6 years, 7 years ago now, Ted, is I thought, you know, There are a lot of folks who either don't have access to HF privileges, or the ham net that is run on HF is on 14.205 megahertz, plus or minus a little bit. On Sunday evenings at, 0 hours UTC Monday, 2400 hours UTC Sunday, on the second Sunday of the month. But as it's at 14.205 megahertz, that is out of the general portion of the band. Plus, as we know, the HF bands can be up and down. Sometimes they work great, sometimes not. Sometimes somebody in Arizona can hear somebody in New York, but not in Oklahoma, you know, because of the way the skip runs, as it were. So I thought, why don't we make a band that or a net that is really generally available for everybody? And we have that net now on Monday nights at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, that is on a local repeater here in Denver, but that repeater is tied into the IRLP, the Internet Repeater Linking Project. For those who are familiar with that, that's on node 9615, which is an IRLP reflector. And a reflector just allows many different IRLP stations, repeater stations, to link into it at the same time. That reflector is also tied into Echolink, which is a way of getting on amateur radio with your computer. Maybe you don't have a radio, or you don't have a way to put up an antenna for a VHF or 2-meter or UHF 440 rig. Echolink will allow you to join us. You have to have a ham license for that as well, but will allow you to join us on our broadcast engineering and information technical information net, is generally what we call it. It doesn't have a specific solid name even after all this time, because we want everybody to join on. We want everybody, not just a broadcast engineer, but just interested amateurs who are interested in technical discussion, to join us, to get on and say, I'm having a problem with this antenna. Does anybody have an idea how I might get this antenna to match up better? And almost every Monday evening, we have quite a brain trust of very seasoned amateur radio operators and broadcast engineers, who may also be hams, who will join us on that net. And we have a great time discussing things, bringing up technical discussions. The last net that we had, we talked about how Norway is essentially doing away with its FM broadcast in favor of digital radio, because so many people in that part of the world now have digital radios. The proliferation of it is enough that many people are using digital radios to listen to digital broadcasts. So that was just one point of discussion during one of our nets here recently. And we invite anybody and everybody with an amateur license to join us. It's so easy to do if you have an IRLP node in your city or close by, or if you have a computer and Echolink. It's very easy, and all of that software is free too, by the way, Ted. So that's a real brief rundown.
Echolink is an amazing thing, and we've had Jonathan Taylor on, the fellow that invented it and maintains it. We've had him on several times, and he's just a real interesting guy to talk to, a real nice guy. But you know, I was going to say something though. You know, with a number of, I guess I want to say, new amateur radio operators, young people that are just getting into the hobby, that are also in the broadcast engineering field, I think the SBE ought to move one of their HF nets, if they want to call it, or part of that, into the general portion of the band, so that those fellas can participate.
Well, you know what? That's a very good suggestion. And WA7BGX runs that net from down in the Arizona area. And you know, I don't know, but what that might not be a great question to ask him one night on the net, or to bring that up to the SBE and maybe have them. I know how to get in touch with Hal. That certainly is something that I could do as well. But, you know, that's why I formed this side of the net. And by the way, the first and third Mondays of the night, of the month, I should say, are official SBE Chapter 73 of the Air, we call it, as an SBE numbered chapter, for Society of Broadcast Engineer news and information, as well as the general discussion. So I wanted to make sure to mention that in conjunction with the net, too. But, you know, that's a great idea, Ted, and it certainly would be worth discussing with Hal sometime and bringing up before, you know, the folks who make those decisions.
Well, you know, you might want to talk just a minute or two about the Society of Broadcast Engineers. For those that are in the broadcasting field, if you're not a member, you don't know anything about the organization. This is something to kind of perk up and listen to. And the rest of you fellas out there that are hams, you need to perk up and listen to, because broadcast radio may be something that you want to get into at some point in time. But
Sure, Ted. Thank you. You know, the SBE, Society of Broadcast Engineers, just celebrated, I think it was the 25th anniversary, if not more. And the website is www.sbe.org. And it, again, is an educational and engineering promoting organization. One of the things that SBE is doing these days is working with the FCC, for instance, to better some of the technical aspects of radio. They're a body that has a lot of influence with the FCC, and it's really a great organization to be a member of. The SBE helps engineers with problems out in the field, helps with legislation and advocacy for broadcast engineering. They do everything from frequency coordination to helping engineers find jobs. It's just a wonderful organization, and everybody, in my humble opinion, who is a broadcast engineer should be a member and support this particular organization. And one of the things that the SBE does is further education. They are really very, very strong and committed to furthering the education of those interested in broadcast engineering. They hold several different levels of certifications. And these days, employers, when they're looking for another engineer, they look especially heavily at those who have SBE certifications, and those certifications are not that difficult to get. You know, if you have a love and an interest in the field, the SBE has so many educational opportunities and information and books and study materials and everything to help you achieve the goals that you'd like to achieve.
I was going to say, and also, when you get the extra class FCC license, if you're a member of the SBE, that's also good for actually a certification, and I'm not sure which one it is.
It sure is. That would be the Certified Broadcast Technologist certification. If you have an extra class license and you work in the broadcast industry and you join SBE, they will give you that automatic CBT certification. I myself am a certified broadcast radio engineer, a certified broadcast networking technician, and I have the AMD, which is the AM directional specialist addition to my SBE certifications, because I used to work in AM before I came to work for this company. Oddly enough, I got my SBE certification as an AM directional specialist and then went to work for a company that has no AMs in it. So there are so many things that you can do and learn and once again grow within the Society of Broadcast Engineers.
You know, I was going to say, though, AM directionals, engineers that know how to do that, know exactly, you know, when the guys that can sit down and bring a directional pattern back in that's been knocked off because lightning blew out something in the phaser or whatever, and maybe you can't find the exact replacement value capacitor or whatever to stick back in. But they have the ability to tune the array and get everything back to where it was. This is a lost art. This is a dying field because there's nobody in it anymore.
It really is, you know, and that's such a good point to make, Ted, because there are so many opportunities for people to get in and learn, you know, that material. And once again, if you have an interest in antennas, if you have an interest, you know, in AM broadcasting, that is such a great way to go, because those types of engineers are needed so much in the industry. I wanted to tell you about a book that I studied to get my SBE certification for AM Directional. And if anything, its title is a little misleading. It's called AM Directional Antennas Made Simple. Well, you know, honestly, Ted, there's not too much that's terribly simple about it, but if you have the interest and you have the desire to want to grow and learn something that's exciting and will help you really grow as a person and an engineer in a field that, still to this day is exciting, then, you know, these types of certifications and job capabilities and abilities are certainly worthwhile pursuing.
Well, you know, as you're as a broadcast engineer, now you were telling me earlier that you really, really loved AM on amateur radio. And
Yeah, it's really neat.
I want you to talk a little bit about that and tell us a little bit about the audio processing that you have and what you do to get the sound on the air. I get a big bang out of listening to AM. I tuned in one night and there was a fellow in there who just has a homebrew PDM rig that he built himself from scratch. And in listening to the guys on AM, I'd have to say it sounds to me like they're a little bit, I guess I want to say, more technically savvy than their counterparts on sideband. Now, that's just an observation. You tell me if I'm wrong.
Well, you know, no, that's probably correct, Ted, from the standpoint of to operate on AM to get that wonderful sound that AM is capable of, the full-bodied, you know, full-fidelity range of sound takes a good microphone, takes a good mic processor. You don't want to overdo things in the amateur bands, yet if you've ever listened to a really clean, beautiful broadcast quality, as the term goes, audio from a ham operator, it's just a beautiful thing to hear, especially, again, if you're interested in this sort of thing. You know, and I've heard some AM stations on the amateur radio bands that just sound incredible. And there's so many of these hams these days that are taking old broadcast transmitters and actually not only restoring them, but converting them for use in the amateur bands. There was a station, I believe, in Peoria, Illinois, that I just recently had the opportunity to hook up with another ham buddy of mine down in the Chattanooga, Tennessee area. And my friend Kenny, K4KR, was going to go and pick up this transmitter and take it and restore it. I think somebody beat him to it because he didn't end up getting that transmitter. But hams will take these transmitters, convert them to the ham bands, beautifully restore them, and then you've got this just absolutely incredible AM transmitter. Now, whether it be a 500-watt or a kilowatt or taking a 5,000-watt transmitter and adapting it for, you know, the lower power that we're allowed in the amateur bands. But it's just a thing to behold. And there are a lot of websites that cater to the AM ham community. And just some beautiful pictures and incredible photos of ham shacks and the equipment that these guys have and the technical knowledge that they've gained from either just getting in there and jumping in and doing it, or maybe they're a broadcast engineer or have so much technical skill that they're able to really take these old rigs and make them sound just absolutely incredible.
Well, what just out of curiosity, what are you running as far as AM is concerned?
Well, my when I get on AM, I use my ICOM IC746, which sounds really wonderful. If I need a little more power, I have a Heathkit SB200 linear amplifier that I can get about 400 to 600 watts out of. And then, of course, my other HF rig, I've been told, sounds real good on AM too. I have a mic processor down here that I run my Heil Classic Pro microphone into. And I've been told on occasion that I have pretty decent sounding audio, Ted.
Well, you know, a lot of folks think now if you're going to get on AM, you're going to have a Heathkit DX100 or a Johnson Viking 2 or something along that line, you know. So, or an old broadcast transmitter, you know, like a, you know, a 250 or 250 GY or something, you know, that that you can get on with. But I found I was listening to AM and I had the 746 on at when my 746 was working anyways. And I got on and I asked, I said, well, you know, does this thing sound bad? You know, does it really sound bad on AM? And the guy said, no. He said, it sounds very passable. So then I didn't feel so, I guess I want to say, out of place getting on with a, you know, a normal sideband rig and running it on AM. But some of those fellas that are on there, they've got some pretty fantastic sounding audio. And, of course, they're running plate modulation and all that kind of thing. But there's also, I also ran into a bunch of fellas that operate obviously on sideband that just really want to give the AM guys a hard way to go. And I don't know about that, you know, because I'm thinking to myself, some of these data modes, you know, they kind of spread out on the dial a little bit too. And but AM, if it's done right, I just don't see a problem in the world with it. I enjoy listening to it. Now, the one thing about AM that I don't like, though, and that is this: if it's got a lot, if you got a lot of static and storms out there around, you can't hear people as well. You know, it's if their audio is not really way up and punchy, you can't hear them, and it gets to the point where it's a little aggravating to listen to. But in clear weather, and a person's got a really good, strong signal and great audio, I mean, it really sounds sweet.
Yeah, there's quite a few people who operate AM here in the Denver area, and I've heard stations down in Foreland, way down in Georgia, that were coming in what we refer to on our signal strength meters as S9 or a little over. And when you've got a signal like that and you can listen to beautiful audio, it's just a pleasure. Sometimes you don't even want to necessarily get on and talk. You just want to listen to how good that amateur radio AM can sound. And by the way, I was going to tell you too, Ted, there is a gentleman up in Maine who repairs the ICOM 746s from the ground up. His name is Mike, and his call is N1EQ. He has a great website on the web. If you look up N1EQ, but he actually takes these rigs and lovingly repairs them and makes them just as good as new. And I wanted to ask you too, on your 746, did you lose the backlight yet?
No, did not. Well, this this thing developed a real strange problem in that it transmits. You know, I haven't put a frequency meter to see where it's transmitting, but it doesn't matter what mode you put it on. You can put it on sideband and select any band. It doesn't matter. And it just puts out about, on the watt meter, it's showing about 200 watts of carrier, but we don't know where it's at. Somewhere.
Yep. That is a common problem with that radio, and believe it or not, there are fixes for it on the internet. And again, just as far as a recommendation, I'd look up N1EQ's webpage, and if you want to send that off and get it repaired, some people do try to attempt that on that particular radio themselves. That's a fairly common problem. Believe it or not, there's a little driver transistor back up on one of the circuit boards. I read about this a couple of months ago, but that's probably what's wrong with your radio. It acts like it's putting out power, but it really isn't.
No, it actually is. I mean, it shows on a watt meter. I mean, you can see it. It's got RF going out the stack, but the problem is we don't know where that, I haven't checked it. I should probably have checked it on a frequency meter. But it doesn't matter. You can put it on sideband; it does it. You can put it on any mode, and there it is. You know, it's just putting out solid carrier. You can change bands; it doesn't matter. So I felt it had to be something in the final stage or in the driver that's oscillating. You know, that's doing something bizarre, and there's an oscillation taking place somewhere. That's just a theory, but, you know, once again, and I have a fear of working on my own stuff. I don't know what it is. I can work on something else, like a piece of broadcast gear I'm perfectly comfortable with, but when it comes to going inside of your radio, I don't know. Of course, there's so much surface mount stuff, too, in there that, it's not like it used to be. On my shelf here, I have a Drake TR-4C and a T4X and the R-4C. And the old Drake radios, something goes wrong, man, you just pick them up and take the bottom and the top off and, you know, plug them into power and grab the multimeter and go at it. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, it's so simple to fix them, you know. But these things that have all this surface mount stuff, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like a bull in a china shop. I don't know if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, you know, that's another area of skill development for somebody who may have an interest in repair. You know, surface mount technology is here to stay, and it's here as the mainstay these days. And if you're qualified to repair that sort of thing, there are opportunities available. So again, don't be afraid to dive in and explore that possibility for yourself.
Yeah, we've got a couple of ICOM 751s that need repair. And I don't know, these radios start getting older, you know. However, by the two 757 GXs I've got here they've been incredible performers, and the only thing that's gone wrong with them is the dial and the readout have drifted apart from each other. So I mean, and I understand there's a screwdriver fix for that. I don't know, I haven't delved into those, but you know, if it says 7.125, chances are it's, you know, it's going to be 5 or 10 kilohertz. It's off, you know, and the people, if you get on frequency, they'll say, well, you cannot get on frequency. Of course, you can kind of cure it with the offset, but, that's the only thing with those radios that, and they both did it at about the same time. They're off about the same. So I imagine it's just aging, you know, it's a cap in there that's getting old or something's happening, causing them to do that, but I've just had not any service trouble with those things at all. So that's been a good thing. Well, let me ask you this. On HF, what kind of antennas do you use? You're a radio engineer, so now you're probably going to be an expert on antennas.
Well, you know, Ted, funny you should ask that. I do have an interesting little setup here. I live in a, pretty suburban area, a non-covenantal area, so I can basically put up whatever antennas I want. And I have a 5-band DX Engineering 5 BTV vertical that I've modified for 12 and 17 meters as well, by essentially just putting on a quarter wave wire for those frequencies fed from the base of the antenna. There's a lot of plans for that on the internet, and I saw that and I thought, hey, that's a great way to have a 7 BTV vertical instead of a 5. So I have that. I also have a 75-meter dipole, full-size 75-meter dipole that is not as high up as I would like, but I'm going to try to remedy that before too long. I have a 160-meter bent all-over creation around the backyard dipole, and that gets me out around the state here pretty well. And then I have a 6-meter, three-element 6-meter homebrew beam that me and one of my sons built, so I have that up. A dual-band J-pole. I've got a couple of different receive antennas for everything from receiving ADS-B, which is essentially following airline flights across the area. Airplanes transmit on these frequencies where they transmit their location. So I can kind of follow airplanes around Denver International Airport and the various other airports here in the Denver metro area. And another receive antenna or two, and that kind of rounds it out.
Well, let me ask you a question. You were talking about receiving the aircraft band signals. Now, are they running AM or are they running FM modulation on the aircraft?
Well, most of the voice on the aircraft these days, still to this day, is AM, which I still find a little unusual as to why they do that, but they do, and evidently that still works for them. The ADS-B, which I cannot remember what that acronym stands for at the moment, but essentially what these airplanes do, these jet airplanes and other airplanes, will put out essentially a transponder beacon, and this software. Well, by the way, let me just say, are you familiar with the little RTL SDR USB sticks?
No, huh?
Look this up on Amazon. You can get them for about $10. Download some free software off of the internet. SDR Sharp, HDSDR. There are several others available, but they essentially allow you to have a software-defined radio with your computer doing all the processing power, and the dongle, the little USB dongle, as they are, they're just about the size of a USB, you know, storage stick, will act as the radio receiver front end, and it turns your computer into a very powerful software-defined radio.
Now, you know what? I have seen those. Matter of fact, I think Matt's got one, and I think Holly picked one up. And they've actually had them, and they almost have like a spectrum analyzer readout on them for.
They do for
tuning around. It was really kind of impressive to see. So anyhow, I was wondering about it, whether they operated AM or FM, because every time I've tuned in aircraft, it was always an AM signal. And I thought, how can that be? But I guess it still is. Now, let me ask you this question here. Now, let's get a little jump gears here. So I hear on all the conspiracy radio broadcasts and the guys that are on talking about it. Let me ask you, what is it that's going on, or do you know, are you permitted to talk about? What is going on that's supposed to be underneath the airport now, in Denver?
You know, it's funny because this past April 1st, the Denver City Council decided that they would play a joke on the public, and April Fool gotcha, as it were, and they put up it was admitted to later, a fake joke website about all of the supposed clandestine tunnels that are under Denver International Airport and all of this kind of rigmarole. And that's all it was. It was just a way for the Denver City Council or whoever, the Denver Airport Authority, I think, more specifically, to have a little fun. And, you know, there's always been these rumors of things that were done during the building of Denver International Airport that weren't really done. The airport manager, who has been there for years, got on and he said, yeah, this was just a little joke we played. But seriously, I've been with this airport a lot of years, and I have been all over it and all around it and all through it. And no, there's not any real secret squirrel stuff going on.
Well, you know, there's supposed to be. See, underneath the airport, now this is underground, okay? There's supposed to be a big, huge area, you know, where the government is going to funnel in people, you know, like a concentration camp, you know? And, I mean, this has been going around for years. I mean, I've heard this, but it was heard this years ago, you know? So I thought, well, you know what? You're there in Denver. Let me just ask you. Let me see if you know anything about it. So you've been around the Denver airport. Have you checked out any of the stairwells that go down? Have you ever?
I've ridden the trains many times underneath and seen some of the side tunnels very quickly as you pass by, and haven't seen anything that really interested me, Ted. You know, it's like my grandmother, my grandmother from back in Tennessee would say years and years ago. I don't set great store by it.
Well, you know, it's funny too, because we hear, I don't know what it is, but we hear all these different things that are going to happen, and it's all doom and gloom. You know, there's going to be, I don't know, for two or three years in a row I heard there's going to be an economic collapse in the United States, and all, you hear all these things. I don't know, people, I guess maybe they enjoy digging this stuff up, maybe they enjoy circulating them, you know. But some of these stories, I know I went up and was looking on one website, and they had pictures of supposed concentration camps here in the United States, you know, that we're going to be occupied by all of us poor folks, you know, and I don't know who's going to go to work every day, and I don't know who's going to pay the taxes, and I don't know who's going to buy products, and I don't know what in the world the government's going to do with all these people and all these concentration camps, you know. But, you know, I mean, there's always a rumor, but I couldn't resist. I had to ask you about the Denver, underneath the Denver airport, because, well, I mean, it's been on Art Bell. I mean, Art Bell's show, there's been guests on there that talk about it. So, I don't know. So now you kind of helped clear the air there, you know, because in a time of emergency, of course, hams are always ready. You know, we're all ready to go, man. We've got everything we need. We've got the generators. We've got the flares in the trunk of the car. We've got antennas. We've got radios and everything you could possibly need to communicate from point A to point B. We're ready and set to go. So I would think that living there where you're at, you'd be real familiar with your surroundings and what's around there, and especially if there was a bunker somewhere that was set up for emergencies or something, you'd probably know about that as well. Do you work much CW?
You know, Ted, I love CW. I love Morse code. I have my original Radio Shack brass Morse code key right here in the shack with me, and I've kept it nice all these years. I am a very busy guy, though, at this point. I have not done an awful lot of CW operating lately, but I do love it. I've kind of branched out a little bit more, though, into the digital modes and some of the opportunities that so many of the digital modes offer for ham radio right now. But yep, CW's classic, and when I have the time, I can still probably do somewhere between, maybe 10 and 13 words a minute receiving Morse code. It's a lot easier to send when you're out of practice like I am. But, you know, the beautiful thing about that is while it's not a requirement by the FCC now for an amateur radio license, there are still so many people who love Morse code. And I'll tell you right now, Morse code will get through as a communication venue when other modes will not.
Well, I think, you know, we've had several suggestions tonight. The first suggestion was that the FCC allow amateur radio operators to operate with their call on Citizens Band, you know, and in a good way to encourage and bring other people into the hobby. Okay, that was one suggestion. The second one, I don't remember what it was. There was another suggestion we had, but one
I
more.
Think we've had several. Yeah.
Now, the one I was going to propose now is I think they should authorize especially on 80 and 40. And then maybe on 15, you know, to encourage a very small portion of the band and call it the beginner's band for CW. So people could get on without feeling self-conscious and go just as slow as they want to go, you know, until they can learn. And I know in other parts of the band, I've heard people say, well, you know, if you tell people to slow down, they will. No, they won't. I've watched this happen. I've seen guys on the air, and what is it? QRO, isn't that the cue signal for slow down? I think it is. I'm not sure.
I think so too. Yeah.
You know, and the guy would just continue lickety split, and then the next thing you know, the QSO just is falling apart. The old novice band, you know, the novice band that we used to be able to get on running 75 watts. I think that even though it's not the requirement, I think there ought to be a portion of the band set aside that is just a very narrow spot on the dial where you can have a QSO at three words a minute if you can endure it, okay?
And, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And somebody else on the other end. Yeah, people are learning CW on the air now. See, there's a difference. Before, you had to be at five words a minute to get the novice ticket and 13 for the general, but now people are actually learning it from ground zero. So there should be, I think, a little CW practice band for guys to get on and communicate back and forth. I don't know. That's my other suggestion for the night.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, Ted, I'll tell you what. You and I have lots of great ideas. We just ain't in charge. However, we can always make the suggestions to the amateur radio community, write an article, do what you're doing and put a radio show on the air and get people to participate and say, hey, that was a great idea. Or, you know, hey, Ted, Jack, that was the stupidest idea I ever heard. You know, that's just one of the beauties of amateur radio and so many things that we have the opportunity to do.
Yeah, and I think that hearing folks like you on the air, who has spent a lifetime in broadcast engineering and broadcasting period, you know, and how and telling how it is that amateur radio and being an amateur radio impacts your professional life and helps round out the areas that other fellas read about in the book, but they don't ever really have a chance to do. And that, I think, is so, so valuable. You know, I'm especially when it comes to antennas. I think that when you are an amateur and you're building wire antennas and you're tuning wire antennas and you're doing all these things, building beams, building verticals, doing all this stuff with aluminum tubing, and you have a chance to, you know, use, and now we have the MFJ antenna analyzers, you know, that we can play with. Incidentally, I don't know if you know this, but Martin Jew's got one now that goes down into the AM broadcast band.
Well, you know what? I'm glad you brought that up, because there's a little piece of gear that I'm real excited about, and I've always loved and wanted an MFJ antenna analyzer, and finally, a couple of years ago, I broke down and got one, and just really, really enjoyed it. The MFJ-259, which is, I think, just about the most popular antenna analyzer on the market. But, Ted, I found something even better that I love even better. In the broadcast industry, and I use this today, I use a piece of gear. It's basically a handheld radio analyzer laboratory. It's called the Agilent Field Fox. Now, this thing cost about $22,000 fully loaded. It will do spectrum analyzation. It'll do Smith charts. It'll do complex impedances. It'll do SWR analyzing. You can use it to do a proof on a broadcast radio station, which includes many measurements of, like I said, just did that the past couple of days. But I found something for the amateur radio community that you don't have to mortgage your home to buy. And it's a little smaller than an iPhone. And another buddy of mine from the Crawford Broadcasting Company turned me on to this, but it's called the SARC, S-A-R-K, 110 antenna analyzer. And it basically is a visually, I'm losing my, I can't remember exactly what I'm after here, but a visual display of a sweep of frequencies to give you SWR. It does from 100 kilohertz, way down below the AM broadcast band, up to 250 megahertz. Now, my big professional, big deal Field Fox goes from 2 megahertz up to 4 gigahertz, and you can get them that cost even more money that go much higher in frequency. But this little SARC 110 antenna analyzer is the most exciting thing to hit the market lately, and it's sold through a Stepper up in Washington State. And I bought one of these a few weeks ago, and it'll fit in your pocket. It'll hook into your computer, and you can, with some free client software that you can download, see all the graphical displays. That's what I was after a minute ago, on your computer, as well as on the little screen of the thing itself that you can carry with you. And it does so much, you wouldn't believe it. I would really encourage you to check that out, because you're talking about antenna analyzers. Man, I'll tell you what.
What is the approximate going rate for that thing? What are they getting for it?
I think I paid around $380 for mine, so it's not much more than an MFJ, and it may actually be a little less in price than their graphical antenna analyzers that they have today.
Now, if it fits in your shirt pocket, that's something.
Yep. It's really something. You know, check it out on the internet when you get a chance.
Well, I'll tell you something. We are out of time, and I want to just say thank you so much for joining us on this QSO radio show and sharing with us all about broadcast radio and your love for shortwave radio and how you got to listening to that as a kid. The whole thing. I really appreciate your story, and I know folks out there are listening now. Thank you. You're an old friend. So,
Ted, thank you very much. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
And folks may want to, you know, if you're listening, you may want to jot an email to Jack and say hello. If you have an email address, I'm sure there may be somebody that has another fellow radio engineer that has an engineering question for you or something.
Absolutely. I'd be glad to do that. Yep, they can reach me at Jack, J-A-C-K, at K-E-0-V-H, Kilo Echo Zero, VictorHotel.com.
All right, and thank you again.
One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham exam ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening.